Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau is off on leave this week, having a lovely time, I hope. So Stanford University's Alex Stamos will be filling in for him, as he often does. He'll be along in just a moment to talk through all the week's security news. And then it will be time for this week's sponsor interview with Jake King of CMD Security. CMD makes some eminently sensible security software for Linux that basically allows you to lock down user accounts to only do what they need to do, and you also get some visibility into execution data on your Linux fleet with CMD. You'd be surprised how much you can spot with just that execution data. When I spoke to Jake a couple of days ago, he was at the hack.lu conference in Luxembourg, and there was a MITRE ATT&CK event happening there as well. So he'll be talking about how people are trying to make the MITRE ATT&CK framework relevant to orchestrated container environments. That is a great chat, and it is coming up after the news with Alex Stamos, which starts now. And Alex, we've seen a bit of action, bit of legal action over the last 24 hours. The big news, I guess, is that WhatsApp is apparently going to sue NSO Group.
That's right. So this is a follow-on to an announcement WhatsApp made earlier in the year that they had discovered an attack against some of their users. So today they provided firm attribution to NSO Group, but in a big surprise, didn't just announce this, but filed a lawsuit in the Northern District of California. So that is the federal court that covers where Facebook and WhatsApp are headquartered, and is kind of the famous place that lots of these lawsuits happen when they involve the tech companies, with four big claims, including claims under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as well as California's state equivalent.
Yes. As part of this, the head of WhatsApp, Will Cathcart, has written up a piece for the Washington Post explaining the move. But I got to say, there's a couple of paragraphs there that raised some red flags for me. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, regular listeners would know I'm certainly not a fan of NSO Group. But let me just read from his statement. Companies should simply not launch cyber attacks against other companies. Responsible actors report vulnerabilities when they are found. They do not use their technology to exploit those vulnerabilities. Likewise, companies should not sell services to others engaged in such attacks. Far more needs to be done to define what amounts to proper oversight of cyber weapons. NSO said in September that human rights protections are embedded throughout all aspects of its work, yet it maintains that it has no insight into the targets of its spyware. Both cannot be true. At a minimum, leaders of tech firms should join UN Special Rapporteur David Kaye's call for an immediate moratorium on the sale, transfer, and use of dangerous spyware. Now, there's two things that sort of jump out to me there. One is that they're making the argument that people who discover vulnerabilities should only disclose them to the vendor. That seems like a pretty dumb argument. And secondly, I don't think it would be beneficial necessarily to completely ban the sale of surveillance software. What do you think about those two points, Alex?
So the point about, you know, disclosing only the company, that is a point he's making in the op-ed. That is not a legal point. So I think one of the interesting things in the lawsuit is that Facebook is alleging that NSO Group themselves rented servers, including from AWS, and launched the attacks from their own infrastructure. So this is a situation where, you know, NSO has basically said, we're selling software. We are equivalent effectively of a commercial version of Metasploit. And Facebook's, you know, believes that they have evidence that that is not true, that this was effectively infrastructure that was set up and maintained by NSO, and that maybe the attack button is pushed by a customer, but that step by step, the responsibility for the attack itself was coming from NSO. And the legal claims rely on the fact that the way that this attack worked had to flow through WhatsApp servers and use WhatsApp servers for setup, and did so in a way that violates the terms of service. Now, there's a long history in the Ninth Circuit of Appeals, which is what the Northern District of California is part of. You know, we don't have to go in a whole lesson of how our legal system works in the United States, but in this part of the United States, there's a bunch of cases around whether or not you can say violating terms of service is a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And by itself, it can't be. But there also is a history of Facebook using the CFAA against bad guys, especially spammers and people who are trying to scrape the site effectively. And so it looks like the Facebook lawyers believe that they can walk through the various legal landmines that have been left by the Ninth Circuit and prove that not only were they, you know, doing something bad, but they are doing so in a way that they knew they were not supposed to, that they transited Facebook systems to do so, that it wasn't really about the vuln itself, but the exploitation of the system live in a violation of terms of service in a way that they had been specifically prohibited. And so there will be an interesting legal fight here, and there's no good example that directly ties to it. There's a lot of good discussion on legal Twitter about this, but I think it is a strong argument, and I don't think it's as broad as some people are maintaining it is. This does not affect people who are selling exploits or even selling, you know, really weaponized exploits or tooling. It's really about people who conduct the attacks themselves, and Facebook is saying that NSO was a actual operational part of that, not just somebody selling software.
Nicole Perlroth from the New York Times actually made a couple of interesting points on Twitter earlier today. You know, she also noticed the Amazon angle to this, right? And that AWS infrastructure was being used. And this might provide an opening for AWS to perhaps join this action or launch its own action over this. And it would make sense for AWS to do that, considering Jeff Bezos, also the owner of Washington Post, which of course, you know, its columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, NSO was implicated in his the surveillance of Jamal Khashoggi and by extension, I guess, his murder. So we might see something there. Would you think that's a possibility?
It's an interesting possibility.
I should point out too that, that the Jamal Khashoggi angle to this, that's me, not Nicole. She was just pointing to the AWS stuff. She didn't make that link, so I wouldn't want people to think I was saying she did.
Right. So it is an interesting question. It is clearly a violation of the terms of service of Amazon Web Services to use their platform to install malware on the phones of journalists. I don't know exactly which rule, but I feel pretty comfortable. There's an AWS rule that captures that. I have never heard of a cloud computing provider using the civil side of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to sue one of their own customers for misuse, especially if they're really paying. Like, something that these people care a lot about is payment fraud. There's no evidence that NSO Group didn't end up paying their bills or use stolen credit cards or something. But that is an interesting question. I think the use of AWS, whether or not Amazon joins, is probably going to be very important, because this means Amazon is sitting on what is probably rock solid proof of who rented those machines and paid for them. And that will be something that will be subpoenaed as part of discovery here, and will be used as evidence that NSO was not just selling software, but was building the infrastructure itself.
Now, look, on a similar theme, Corellium has filed its response to Apple's lawsuit, and we won't get bogged down in that because otherwise, you know, we'll have spent all of the show thus far talking about, mobile security-related lawsuits, but it's all the stuff you would expect there. There's some interesting allegations in there where Corellium basically said that it got stiffed out of Apple's bug bounty, blah, blah, blah. It's not too hard to sniff around and find the actual filing. You can take a look in this week's show notes to find that. So yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. Now, I want to move on to another story here, and this one, it's really unclear what's happened. It's one of those stories that sort of started unfolding on Twitter, and then we've seen a couple of reports and a couple of counterclaims. But long story short, it looked like some malware that popped up on VirusTotal implied that a nuclear reactor, that the network of the operator of a nuclear reactor in India had its domain controller popped, which is pretty interesting. But now we've seen Indian government people saying, well, you know, it's a fully air-gapped network, so this didn't happen, but maybe it was their administrative network. So, you know, we got this weird little thing in the show notes where we've got like tweets and counter tweets and an Ars article and a Diplomat article, and it's not really clear what's happened here.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. So it looks like this started with a former member of the National Technical Research Organization, a cybersecurity analyst, who pointed out something that he hints that he had known about before, based upon a file in VirusTotal that, if you look into it, had a net command. So, you know, before PowerShell was the cool way to run your malware on Windows boxes, we had net.exe. And there's a hard-coded net command that refers to KKNPP/administrator. So this would be the domain administrator on a domain called KKNPP. He claims that that stands for Kunden Kulam Nuclear Power Plant. And so there was a back and forth. The denials seem to be really focused on the idea that this malware could not have affected the control systems. That seems likely. I can't believe that anybody would attach actual nuclear control systems to the internet. But it would also be shocking to me if there was not a network at any nuclear power plant in the world that didn't have some internet connection, right? People have to be able to send email. They need to be able to talk to their corporate bosses. They have to be able to do research online. And so it seems quite possible that this is malware that was built for that. If so, then we're talking about malware that was custom built specifically for this power plant that clearly was based upon some kind of reconnaissance against their network, since it has like a hard-coded IP address and such. So it does seem plausible that this was targeted at them. And I think the denials kind of ring a little false. This would be a hell of a false flag operation if you're just trying to get people to believe it.
Yeah, I mean, they are pulling a bit of a fake news, air gap, right? But that's, no one really claimed that it was necessarily on the control network, but it does feel like maybe they got their administrative network popped, hey?
Which will have some very sensitive stuff, right? Yeah. You're clearly going to have documentation of what's going on. You'll have information about employees. You might have information that would be useful if you are a country that's trying to build your own nuclear power plants. I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff on there that's useful, and that would definitely lead towards a reason why somebody would build enough malware to target one domain controller in one Indian plant.
Do we know much about the malware in this instance, like where it might have come from, what it was trying to achieve?
Yeah, so from looking at the malware on VirusTotal, there's some people that believe this is related to things that have been built by North Korea's Lazarus Group in the past, that it shares code with a piece of malware that attacked a bunch of important South Korean companies in 2013. But again, that kind of, as we'll talk about, I think later, that kind of attribution can sometimes be tough. It would not be insane, though, to think about the North Koreans using malware against an Indian nuclear plant. Certainly, nuclear research is something that North Korea is very interested in.
Yeah, or they just wanted to do some Dogecoin mining on the domain controller, you know? You never know.
Who knows, yeah.
The world is full of stupid right now. Oh, now this is awesome because it's like a story from 20 years ago. The country of Georgia suffered a mass defacement. Like, you don't see mass defacements anymore, really. But yeah, 15,000 websites got defaced because like a hosting provider that seems to have a lot of websites from Georgia on it got popped.
Yeah, I'm really disappointed that this defacement didn't have a bunch of ASCII art and shout outs to everybody's handles. no, this one's interesting. I mean, it's kind of overblown that they're saying 15,000 sites, but like you said, one web host got popped.
Yeah.
And a bunch of sites got overlaid with a picture that says, "I'll be back," over a picture of Mikhail Shaskavili, who is the former president of Georgia, who was seen as a pro-Western reformer, who was chased out of Georgia and is now living in Ukraine. So it looks like it's a politically motivated, some kind of hacktivist group. Some people were kind of tying it to the Russians. There's no evidence of that, nor is there any love lost between the Russian security services and Shaskavili. So I really, you know, it probably looks like a individual political group got lucky popping one host that just happens to have thousands of interesting Georgian sites on it.
Yeah, it's like it's 2001, right? Like that's kind of how it used to be.
It's a lot of flashback here.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, we got a story here from CyberScoop that says that Fancy Bear has been going after 16 athletic organizations ahead of the Tokyo Olympics, the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, in keeping with what they've been doing previously at the Winter Olympics and stuff, and we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, there's a lot of history, actually, of GRU activity against Olympic organizations, specifically the World Anti-Doping Agency. As I'm sure most of our listeners know, the Russians got caught big time running a massive doping scheme and therefore were banned from several Olympics. That is what gave us the spectacle of a number of Russian athletes having to march under this unaffiliated flag. So they are still able to, in some cases, compete, but they couldn't do so officially on behalf of Russia. And so, not surprising that the GRU was back in attacks against the Tokyo Olympics. It would certainly be in their best interest to try to disrupt the proceedings and perhaps demonstrate that when the Olympics exclude Russia for even a good reason, that they are running a risk of catastrophe. To be said, I got to visit Tokyo when I was still at Facebook. And even though it was years before the Tokyo Olympics, the various Japanese agencies were extremely focused on the cyber threat. I think they were mostly considering the North Korean threat. But they are quite competent in defense of cyber, and they have a number of agencies that are working very hard on this. So this will not be an easy nut to crack, I think, for the Russians.
Now, when I was on leave a couple of weeks ago, Andy Greenberg published an excerpt from Sandworm, which looked into Olympic Destroyer. And, last week, of course, when I got back on deck, I had something like 18 pages of links to news articles. And considering it dealt with stuff that happened a while ago, the story didn't survive triage. But I did get a chance to have a read of it. And it's a really good excerpt here that brings to light a lot of details about Olympic Destroyer that we didn't previously know. The thing that I found most interesting about it is just what a good job the Koreans did in terms of responding to this very sophisticated attack.
Right. Excellent response by the South Koreans, but also some really good work by, it looks like, again, GRU in covering their tracks. And I think, like you said, this is very well written. I think everybody should read it. There's no reason for us to ruin it for folks. But it's an excellent dive into the attribution problem and demonstrates what professional groups can do when they are motivated. I think a lot of our discussion of Russian activity is distorted by the fact that in most cases, they don't care about getting caught, right? There's the fact that it is Russian groups is part of the message they are sending. But in this case, they very much wanted to apparently frame up the North Koreans and went to extreme lengths to do so. Anyway, I recommend everybody read it. And it looks like this is going to be a fantastic book. I think I'm not shocked. Andy Greenberg is one of the best in the business. He's a fantastic reporter. But it's just a very gripping writing when you consider that this is mostly people staring at screens reverse engineering malware, but he's able to make it a much more exciting conversation. He also talks about going and visiting the building in Moscow, which I got to say he's got more guts than I do.
Yeah, that part was interesting. So, I do actually have an advanced copy of Sandworm, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet because I've been too busy moving house and all of that. But very much looking forward to giving it a read. But you know, just on that attribution side, it is a really interesting read because, you know, essentially they were playing, you know, conducting psychological warfare against incident responders and malware analysts. But look, again, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater because in the end we got there, right? So I think, so far, this type of false flagging, and you know, same with the Turla/oil rig takeover, I think you can only muddy the waters for so long at this stage. Anyway, it is interesting to see these sorts of games being played. Zach Whitaker has a great story up here for TechCrunch. The FCC in the United States is apparently mulling rules that would force telcos to remove certain equipment from their networks, certain Huawei and ZTE equipment. And they're even talking about like subsidizing that process and paying people to get rid of it. This is a pretty serious escalation.
Yeah, this is a big deal. You know, the DHS and the FCC have been signaling this move for a while now, but now they have made a decision to go and to pay the smaller regional telcos who perhaps have installed Huawei and ZTE equipment for price purposes, that to pay them to replace it with more trustworthy devices. I think this is a big deal because it does demonstrate to America's allies, especially the ones like the UK and Germany, who have been a little wishy-washy on what their response is going to be to Huawei. It demonstrates that the US government cares enough to spend money, which is really the only signal that matters between governments, I think. So, it's a big move. I don't know exactly how much money we're talking about in the end, but not a good sign for Huawei and ZTE, because this is not going to be helpful for their fight to demonstrate that they are legitimate and trustworthy partners.
We got an interesting piece here from courtesy of ZDNet that says that the city of Johannesburg is essentially having its data ransomed by attackers unknown. They've called themselves the Shadow Kill Hackers, which I think is a hilarious name for a hacking crew, personally. But yeah, this isn't a ransomware attack. Essentially what they've done is they have stolen the data and they were saying, unless you give us 4 bitcoins, we're going to publicly publish it and that will be terrible for you. As of the time of recording, the city of Joburg has said that it's not going to pay, but the attackers thus far have not released the data. So, you know, do you think this could be a crime type we'll be seeing more of, or do you think this is maybe a bit of a one-off?
So there's a lot of history of this kind of crime type. You know, we had back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there were a lot of, you know, I'm going to use SQL injection to exfil your database and hold you ransom. It's very rare that somebody would pay that. And if they would, back in those days, they would have to pay with something like Western Union or a wire transfer. And so the odds of somebody getting caught were much higher. I, in fact, worked a case with some people who were dumb enough to show up to a Western Union in the Netherlands, and the cops were shocked that they fell for it.
The cops jump out from behind the pot plants and, you know, it's into the squad car with you.
Right. Thank you for showing your ID to pick up the money that was sent by your victims. But in the Bitcoin era, it's not quite that easy. Now, Bitcoin is obviously not totally untraceable, and we have real strong evidence of that from the very recent shutdown of a South Korean child exploitation site. But more recently, this kind of fraud has been happening against individuals. That there has, you know, been a spate of hacking of individual iCloud accounts, of personal, you know, things like Snapchat accounts and such, and then the ransoming of data of I'm going to show these naked photos. So that is, you know, kind of what we call sextortion, is incredibly impactful and has led to some really sad personal outcomes. This is kind of the citywide version of that. But clearly the information is not as sensitive and the likelihood of a organized city paying up versus a scared teenager is much less. Yeah. And so I think they're doing the right thing here. If they ended up paying, what happens sometimes in those situations where it's an individual extortion is they enter into this relationship with their extorter where they are continuously extorted over a multi-year period. And unlike crypto lockers, there's no guarantee that once you pay your ransom and that it's over, right? At least if a crypto locker actually does get unlocked, then you have your data back. But in this situation, the bad guys will continue to have the data. There's no reason why they couldn't come back. And so I think not paying up front is the only reasonable way to play this game.
Yeah, I saw Grok tweeting about this saying, I predicted that this sort of thing was going to become more common. But I think, you know, I think you're right, because the other factor is too that there's no operational disruption from someone having your data necessarily, right? Like, it's not like ransomware where you can't admit patients to your hospital, you can't sell them electricity credits for redemption so that they can turn their lights on. Like, it's a different type of attack, isn't it?
It is. It's very different in a city context. And I mean, the other thing here, that to just be totally cynical, is the people who take the impact of the data being released are the citizens of the city. It is possibly not the politicians themselves. So, there's a little bit of a weird dilemma here of who would really be motivated to pay this kind of ransom.
Yeah, yeah. We got another one from ZDNet here. A Vietnamese student has been unmasked as the author of essentially some, you know, Android adware, but it has a massive install base, like millions of users. And ESET put on their Brian Krebs hat and just like basically figured out who this guy was. And it was really easy. It was like funny easy.
Funny, easy, a little sad, easy. The ability for one kid to have this many malware installs in the Play Store, I think is just another strike against Google. The Google Play Store is a mess. And it's just, you know, completely nuts that this was able to, you know, technically get past all their controls, but also that their kind of, e-crime threat intel team is not picking up this kind of stuff and doing the same work that ESET did. They need to really work on both the defensive technical controls, but also offensively how they're going to go after these malware authors who are able to use the same code over and over again in many different, in this case, super cheap apps.
Yeah, 42 apps with millions of installs. So yeah, that's embarrassing for all concerned. The National Security Agency's Cybersecurity Directorate is headed by Anne Neuberger. She's made some comments about how NSA needs to do a better job of declassifying, cybersecurity related information. I mean, that to anyone who's familiar with the way that process works right now, like that is stating the obvious. It's a hilariously broken process, isn't it? And I don't think people quite understand how bad it is. I mean, you can give the government malware samples that have come off your own network, and then they'll say, oh, we can't talk about these because they're classified, right? It's just ridiculous.
Right. The government acts as a data diode. All this data goes in, it gets classified, and then it's very difficult for them to share it with others or to return to the people that shared with them with other interesting data. I once had a quote-unquote classified briefing in a SCIF by the government, and almost all the data that they showed me and the other CISOs who were being briefed came from my team 6 months before. And in fact, I answered the questions of the other CISOs because I was able to give them details in a non-classified manner. It's just a nutty system. And one of the core problems is that NSA and DHS, and to a certain extent FBI, have this issue where they will brief people in private industry about information that comes from these, secret sources and methods, or that have geopolitical issues, right? So they can give a briefing and they can say, it's this general is running this agency and these are their goals. But when you're a defender in a big American company, what you really need is you need the technical details necessary to see whether or not this malware or this type of attack or this C2 server shows up anywhere in your logs.
Yeah, we don't need pictures of kernels. Just give us the SHAs and the IPs, right?
Yeah, right. Like it's great. Thank you for telling us the overblown story of how you figured this all out. But we really would like to leave this room is a bunch of SHAs and IP addresses. And those are things that have to be typed into unclassified computers at some point. And so they can't be classified. So that's what I hope Neuberger is really working on is, sure, you have people with clearances at most major American companies that are legitimate targets. You can give them nice big classified briefings. They can clap at the end of all the thoughtful stuff that you've done. But what they have to be able to leave with is a USB key with a bunch of unclassified IOCs, because that is what we really need. And those need to be timely. IOCs, have a very rapid decay curve of their usefulness. And so getting something 6 months later is generally completely useless.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because Cyber Command, one of the criticisms of them putting stuff on VirusTotal is that, a lot of the stuff they're putting out there is quite old, right? So I have seen that criticism of them. And it's interesting, though, because we've got a story here about Cyber Command backing off, apparently, its plans to put some more North Korean malware on VirusTotal. And the story here kind of implies that's because nuclear de-escalation talks are resuming with North Korea. But, and even if that's true, I find this interesting because it tends to suggest that maybe Cyber Command doing this is making North Korea unhappy, which would be evidence that it's working.
Yeah, I have been a big fan, as we've talked about on the show, of Cyber Command having this persistent engagement of them basically trolling America's adversaries by burning their malware. In the North Korean situation, it does seem that they're taking it much more personal than other places. I expect the Chinese and Russians are like, this is just the cost of doing business. But the North Koreans are relying on Lazarus Group, not just for intelligence gathering, but for the generation of hard currency to help keep the regime afloat. And also, nobody's ever accused the North Koreans of underreacting to a cyber incident. And so I think, it's probably reasonable for Cyber Command to walk on eggshells around them.
Now, Amazon appears to be catching a bit of heat over the Capital One breach, a bit of political heat. Senator Warren, Senator Wyden have written a letter wondering how much blame we can apportion to AWS over those breaches. Specifically, they're wondering if Amazon should have introduced better protections against SSRF targeting their customers.
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, I think, for most people would consider cloud computing environments as not responsible for the vulnerabilities in software. SSRF is a little special in that in the Capital One breach and in a number of other breaches that the target of the SSRF of passing through these front-end web and proxy servers was to hit the AWS metadata service. And so the fact that AWS is a metadata service that is particularly vulnerable in it, architecturally to this is one of the things that people have talked about. And so I do think it is smart for AWS to do some architecture here, but you know, web apps have vulnerabilities. And yeah. I think it's perhaps overstating it a little bit to put so much blame on AWS. I do think that the fact that the suspect was a former AWS engineer does kind of add to some of the environment of this letter coming out, that effectively what they're saying is, you know, not only was this a vulnerability that AWS is naturally vulnerable to, but that was clearly known by this one engineer and she was able to take advantage of it. And so I do think AWS needs to be thinking about this architecturally. Other cloud computing providers have, as you know, for example, Google Cloud has changed how some of this stuff works. I think this is a little overstating it, and I think Capital One is still responsible for it.
Yeah, I think it's good, though, to sort of hold some feet to the fire when stuff like this happens, though, because, you know, I don't think it's going to go anywhere beyond a letter, but it is kind of good to put these tech providers on notice and say, hey, we're noticing stuff, we're watching you.
Right. Even an infrastructure as a service provider is not a neutral provider of services that they just throw over the fence for people to implement. They have a responsibility to understand these are the kinds of vulnerabilities that naturally arise from the architecture and the design that we are encouraging through the way our product is built. And so I do think it is smart to keep their feet a little bit in the fire, but I also hope that this does not lead to the idea that AWS is naturally less secure. There are trade-offs moving to the cloud. From my perspective, most of the trade-offs moving to the cloud are positive from a security perspective.
Moving on, and Axios managed to get its grubby mitts all over an internal White House memo, which was a pretty disturbing read. It goes into details about some drama occurring, involving the security team at the White House. Talk us through this one, Alex.
Yeah, so this memo was the resignation letter of Dimitrios Vostakis, who was the chief of defense on the unclassified side of the White House. So there was a major breach during the Obama administration of the unclassified White House network. As a result, there was a new office of the chief information security officer, the OCISO, that was built in the White House, and that was staffed by very competent people. And as we have seen in a number of places in the Trump administration, those people have kind of reached their limit of how long they can operate in the federal government under this president. In this case, Vostakis specifically points out that people in this office are being treated poorly by political appointees. And he is saying that this is opening up the White House and therefore the United States to attack. I think this is actually really scary. This kind of barn-burning memo out the door, I think, is not very common with people at this very high level of the government. And I think we need to listen to somebody who has real experience here about the kind of risk that we are running as a country.
It certainly paints a picture of some pretty incredible dysfunction, doesn't it?
It does. And the, you know, part of the context for here is that some of the discussion around impeachment that is going on right now has to do with the use of classification of different servers in the government to try to cover up things for political purposes. So kind of the politicization of the executive office of the president, the people who actually make the bits move around and the paperwork happen in the executive branch, is a real sad thing to see. These are, you know, people who could make 4 to 5 times as much money working in the private sector, who have stayed in their jobs out of a sense of duty, the fact that they are finally being chased out of the White House, I find incredibly disturbing.
Yeah. Well, look, switching gears from some somewhat depressing U.S. government news to some somewhat good U.S. government news, Caesar, which seems to be rolling out a string of sensible policy proposals, is suggesting, Caesar, of course, being the cybersecurity agency as part of the Department of Homeland Security, they are suggesting that all U.S. government agencies should have a vulnerability disclosure program. This seems like a really good idea.
I think it is. And it's fascinating that a lot of the little bright spots in the federal government from a cybersecurity defensive perspective are coming from CISA. You know, one of the challenges that the U.S. executive branch has is that all of these departments run their own IT shops top to bottom, including security. And so as a result, there has classically not been a one-stop shop that you can go to if you believe that there is a security issue in the government. this does not fix it, but it seems like a step in that direction of pushing towards all of these agencies having a vulnerability disclosure process, effectively requiring them have a security at alias at some point and a way for people to disclose responsibly. I would love to see this turn into a federal government-wide bug bounty. That seems to be the direction that CISA is pointing at.
We got one from Wired here, which is, it's an interesting piece, actually. It's sort of looking at the, a bit of paralysis, I guess, in Congress in looking at how to deal with the ransomware issue. Because there are people in Congress who want to do something about it, and there are other people saying, hey, this isn't a federal government issue. So it's a good little write-up, this.
It is a good write-up. I think it's important. I'm not sure... even myself, that I have a lot for Congress to do. So one of the real challenges we have in the United States is that the government that most people deal with every day is the local and state government, right? I might be a little special because I know some FBI agents and, have to go do things like briefings at government agencies like we were talking about. But the vast majority of Americans pretty much never run into a representative of the federal government except when they pay their taxes to the IRS. When you get a driver's license, when you deal with your property taxes, when you buy or sell a house, when you're arrested by somebody, those are all employees of the local municipality, county, or state. And so as a result, all of these thousands and thousands of little governments throughout the United States run their own IT, and they have really basic problems of still running Windows XP, not patching even their current Windows systems, having shared admin passwords, having a vulnerability to Mimikatz. And there's not a real golden arrow here for Congress. From my personal perspective, the place Congress should start is election security, because the U.S. Constitution gives them power to regulate election security specifically. And so I think that's a place where there's less federal issues. But in the long run, we have to find a model by which all of these state and especially localities are not running all their IT individually. And I think that will probably be a state-by-state solution, and perhaps towards the push towards a clouds that are operated by commercial companies on behalf of states is the way we should go, because this is just not a sustainable solution to have, where I live, San Mateo County, have its own CIO, have its own IT team, and to run everything on its own with all of my personal data and that of my children stored away, to be doing that completely by itself and perhaps going up against professional attackers from GRU, SVR, MSS, and the like.
Yeah, agreed. Oh, God, we got a really dumb proposal here from the Australian government. Fantastic. Apparently, elements of the Australian government are interested in using a proposed facial recognition database, a federally operated facial recognition database, to do age verification for access to pornography. I can't even.
Yeah, this is surprising to see after the UK finally gave up on a multi-year effort to build porn verification. First off, no engineer is going to want to try to build the system that stands between 15-year-olds and porn, right? Like, you're talking about an incredible set of crowdsourced capabilities when you talk about the entire nation's set of young people trying to beat your system. Completely unrealistic that you could build anything like that, like this, that is not a massive violation of privacy. And most likely, you would massively violate people's privacy and barely slow down the standard 14-year-old by about 14 minutes before they were able to get access. I just think it's a ridiculous idea, has all kinds of side effects, and is just really, really stupid.
Okay, we're on the home stretch here, Alex. And, I think it was last week or the week before, Adam and I spoke about the COMAC C919 aeroplane, which was apparently cobbled together with a bunch of stolen IP. A university in Australia, Monash University, has apparently partnered with that Chinese state firm to do research, partnered with COMAC. It boggles.
That's right. This is, I think, just a great example of something that's happening right now, which is the People's Republic of China is on a major offensive to gain influence all over the world, in the Western world. And one of their entry points is universities in Australia, in the United States, in Europe. One of my colleagues here at Stanford, Larry Diamond, a famous political scientist, helped write a big report called Chinese Influence in American Interests. And while it's about America, it really applies to almost any Western country. And I think it's a good read for people who are interested in all that kind of non-cyber ways that the Chinese are buying their ways into partnerships and such. And this is just a great example of a school that is not willing to give up the money, even though they know that they would be partnering with an organization that hires hackers to break into competitors.
Yeah, wow. Now, look, we're going to finish with this absolutely hysterical follow-up to a story that Adam and I first discussed back in July. The story was that a defense contractor had sent classified military equipment to a bunch of scammers who are using Yahoo Mail inboxes, right, with the address like navy-mil.us. They somehow managed to scam this stuff. And, you know, it wasn't espionage. At the time, we even said, I went back and listened, and it was like, yeah, this looks like it's just straight up fraud. And no one really knew what happened to this $3.2 million worth of very sensitive military technology that went that was sent to these scammers. It has turned up. And the story of it turning up is as awesome as the initial story about it getting fraudulently obtained. Please walk us through this one.
Okay, so there is a class of reality show in the United States where people buy into abandoned public storage units and sight unseen, and then dive into them to try to figure out if there's anything valuable in them. It was a woman who is a star of one of these stores paid $6,900 for this unit, thinking that it might have some valuable camera equipment, some music equipment, who jump into it and find Boeing classified systems sitting there. And so this is just like an amazing confluence of 2019 American reality show culture mixing with international espionage.
But it wasn't espionage. This is the thing. It was like Nigerian scammers using Yahoo Mail managed to actually get this stuff. And then they've stashed it in a storage unit. They haven't paid the bill. And now a reality TV star bought it and found it. Oh my God. And this story, and I hate linking to the Daily Mail, but they actually got the story, right? And the really funny part is, like, they rang up Boeing and they're like, we've got this stuff here. Boeing told them, just keep it safe till Monday. And then they wind up getting raided by like armed government agents, and they're closing off the street. It's a wild ride, this piece.
It's completely bizarre. I really hope this gets turned into like a dark comedy. Although you wouldn't believe it, right? Like if you turned in a script to Hollywood with this story, they would kick it back as being too unrealistic. It's just completely bizarre.
Well, Alex, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for stepping up and filling in for Adam. It's always great to have you on the show. I've really enjoyed it. Cheers.
I really enjoyed it too. Please feel free to send Adam on vacation whenever you want.
That was Alex Stamos there with a look back at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jake King from CMD Security. I am a big fan of CMD. They make some very good Linux security software, and you've probably heard me describe it before. But I'm going to describe it again. The basic idea behind CMD, there's two parts. There's the control part and the visibility part. On the control side, you can use CMD to restrict Linux account actions, right? So you can restrict service accounts from being able to do stuff that they don't need to do while still giving those accounts the permissions that they require to do what they do need to do. Now, the same thing goes for dev accounts, engineering accounts, actually any Linux account, even root. And you can even do some pretty nifty granular stuff. You can set up their software to allow system administrators to approve like sudo commands via duo push. It is very, very slick. And on the other side is the visibility component. Capturing execution data from Linux boxes can tell you an awful lot about what's happening in your Linux environment. CMD has been going long enough now that they have a decent sized corpus of execution data that they've able to gain some insight from. And you're going to hear a bit about that in this interview. But yeah, Jake King, who is a co-founder of CMD, he was in Luxembourg this week for the HackLU conference, also the CERT EU summit, and a side event all about MITRE ATT&CK. And he was speaking there about applying MITRE ATT&CK to container environments, which is apparently still kind of a work in progress. But anyway, Jake joined me for this chat and started off by telling me about some of the talks he's seen this week. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, actually, kind of continuing on the theme from the Trailer Bits conversation last week, you know, there was a number of talks on containers, obviously namespaces, container technology. One that stood out to me personally was a presentation done by the CERT EU team on really who contains the containers, looking at different exploit chains, vulnerabilities that people are leveraging to compromise, you know, container environments in production. And you know, as Stefan mentioned last week, Kubernetes is actually built in a pretty solid way. What I found pretty interesting was a lot of the talk kind of centered around abuses of configuration, which is, you know, to no surprise, a lot of what kind of was covered last week. And what was super impressive to me is people are now focusing on containers and workloads in orchestrated container environments, and it's definitely something that's hit our eye and something that my team and I are presenting on today at the extension to the CertEU Summit, the attack workshop today, talking about container security in general and how there still is some room to improve. You know, what we've found is that the kind of companies that are leveraging container orchestration or, you know, Kubernetes type deployments in their production environments, they tend to have, you know, host hardening, and they're either using a deployed variant of Kubernetes GKE or EKS in their environment. But really, where I find that there is a bit of room for improvement is around, you know, kind of how we grant authorization to those systems and architecting them in a at least a DevOps friendly and cloud friendly way that doesn't really slow down the way we interact with that fleet. I think what was kind of brought to light by a lot of our customers is, you know, we talked a little bit about the MITRE ATT&CK framework last time we spoke, and looking at behavioral interactions with systems was a massive part of what people were talking about. We're now a couple of months into doing that. Billions of executions have gone through those policies, and about 60,000 events kind of fell out the bottom end of it with interesting alignment to indicators of compromise or different patterns of abuse. I think really what we've found is quite interesting about container environments is it is quite easy to fat finger the wrong thing in a deployment, or even worse, kind of be troubleshooting in a live deployment of a container environment and gaining access to those systems with, you know, some pretty substantial privileges. I think one of the things that, you know, really stuck out last week that Stefan had mentioned is, you know, by default, Kube's pushing a lot of credentials to, each of the pods that are deployed within its, little network. And if we're not thinking about compensating controls to, you know, detect when people might be probing for credentials or, you know, sniffing around on a host for environment variables that might be sensitive, even through the Kube console or different mechanisms to exec into a container, you've just got a very different challenge to face. And it's a challenge that we've started to help some customers out with.
This is the thing. Stefan last week, he was like at pains to point out, like, no, we weren't covering really lateral movement as a risk here. And it's like, because that's one of the sticky ones, right? And that's where you do need your compensating controls.
Yeah, even things like attribution, looking at, you know, the way someone can gain access to a container, you know, Docker exec into a container or a kubectl, an action inside a container is hard to do. It uses a lot of logs from lots of different systems. And, you know, thinking about something like multi-factor authentication for shell access inside a container is kind of a bit of a pipe dream for a lot of folks. It's something that we've been working towards, and, we're demonstrating some of those capabilities with environments and customers that we work with today. It's really about understanding the attack surface here, because I think a lot of companies don't really understand what that attack surface is yet. And look, to be really honest, you know, Stefan did call it out pretty accurately. There's a pretty solid fabric here that we can use to deploy some really cool tools. We're putting developers in front of that tool and hoping for the best. It's about, you know, leveling up at the same time and building the right controls in at the right times to not slow them down, but to improve the way we can think about, risks to those environments. Look, Kube is here to stay for at least, the near future, and namespaces and containers are just a part of that conversation.
Yeah. So you're speaking, I believe, as soon as you finish this interview, you're going to run down there and speak. Why don't you give us a bit of an idea about what you're speaking about?
Yeah, we're actually kind of continuing on from where we left off at the last MITRE ATT&CK Summit. We've been working closely with the working group that contributes a lot of feedback to MITRE directly about how the framework works. Feedback from customers if you're a vendor, or feedback from SOC teams or cert groups as to how they're leveraging MITRE ATT&CK. And really, what we're talking about today is, you know, we'd solved the problem around fetching a lot of this data from native systems in cloud and data centers.
But now you've looked at the data, right? And that's where it gets interesting.
We have. And you know, inferring things like privilege escalation or lateral movement, file modifications, changes, things like that. You know, the micro view of the data is quite interesting when you start to put it in, you know, some different honeypots. But when you actually see it running in a production environment, you know, one thing that came across to us was clear improvement around signatures and actually adding a little bit of logic to detect abuse in stages is going to be super important for us.
It's interesting when you start talking about signatures because, you know, we are really just talking about some very fundamental information that you're capturing from these hosts. It's nothing too exotic, is it? It's really just, you know, you'd almost consider it sort of metadata, wouldn't you?
Execution data, yeah. When we look at an abuse on a production workload, it's not like the volume of data that you'd see from a traditional kind of EDR or log system that's running on a Windows and Mac endpoint in an environment. It's far reduced from that set of data. And you know, when you really do think about it, the outliers stick out like sore thumbs when you do have teams you know, getting into an environment and doing something a bit unusual. How that aligns with attack and how we're continuing this today is one of the biggest things that our customers started talking about is, you know, we are moving off native hosts and, you know, we know you've got some solutions for containers and, you know, we're looking to kind of understand how we apply these very standard, you know, taxonomies to detecting risks around ad hoc actions in container environments. So we're doing some demonstrations on some new technology that we're currently in active beta with customers. As we speak, and really an extension of our current technology that does operate in containers as well to provide the same level of, you know, action control that we've talked about in the past. I think really where it gets very interesting is this is a problem that's rearing its head in some of the largest organizations in Europe, at least with the conference we're talking at today. And it's interesting to think people are, you know, it's interesting to see people are thinking about how they can apply these taxonomies to understanding risk within these environments. You know, it goes along with saying, you know, this isn't the, you know, the be all and end all. We all have to still harden our containers and verify our images and do those kind of good hygiene things and configure it in the right way. But there is a kind of ongoing maintenance and management of that fleet that's going to probably involve some interaction and we're definitely seeing that is valuable to the folks in the room.
But I mean, it would have been really interesting for you to just, you know, sit there on a pile of data and then just crunch it, and then eventually the anomalies are going to start popping out. And you would have had signatures come to you that you wouldn't have necessarily thought to have written. You know, like I'm guessing that was kind of the process there.
That's right. It's part of the process is just looking at what's normal, what's abnormal behavior through, you know, just standard kind of anomaly detection and maybe some models that were built internally to look at large volumes of data. But really,
thank you for not saying machine learning. Well done. we're using really artificial intelligence. Oh.
Yeah.
Look, the other thing that just occurred to me is it reminds me of my conversations with Stephen Ridley around the stuff he was doing with detecting IoT threats, right? Because, you know, basic things, IoT things, tend to be a little bit more predictable than an endpoint, right? So you just mentioned, well, this isn't like taking CrowdStrike data or something, you know, like full EDR data. Because generally these workloads are going to be a bit more predictable than a typical enterprise endpoint, right? So it sort of makes it a somewhat easier problem to consistently address across different organizations.
I'd say it's a different problem to address. It's certainly you know, something that you know has a lower volume of data and maybe a bit more explicit nature to what someone's doing on a host. People generally aren't browsing YouTube and
Like normal in a workload looks a little bit more consistent across different deployments. Versus endpoints. God, who knows.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And I think the biggest part of these new frameworks is how do we apply them to modern workloads? And MITRE ATT&CK was really centric around endpoint, and you know, it didn't involve network too much. When we started aligning with it, we really started aligning with it because companies were trying to understand you know, the high level attributes of what actually pertained to a risk. And I think the really valuable thing that we're coming out of, at least with this presentation, is you know what people can actually do today with the signatures available, and you know what open source technology, not only vendor technology like ours, but open source technology they can use to collect some similar amounts of data for themselves to see if there's value in the ability to do this kind of thing in their own environment. I think you know an extension of that is you know, as we start to improve and build upon the MITRE ATT&CK framework through workshops like this, we're going to see it start to apply really, really well to a lot of these modern fleets. And, you know, hopefully some of the feedback and the data we've collected today is going to add to the framework's usability in modern container environments as well.
So is the ultimate goal here that you're going to have a signature for that square in the matrix and a signature for that square and like three for that one? And, you know, then CISOs can sit there with their little highlighter pens and go tick, tick, tick. Is that kind of the idea?
I don't necessarily think it's just boils down to signatures. Sometimes it's just having data points that you can feed into, you know, detectors that look unusual. Hey, you know, is lateral movement between these two hosts something that you understand or should see? Is privilege escalation from one developer or group of developers in particular normal? What's really important to understand here is the taxonomy is far from complete in a lot of different areas. And, you know, if you just go to tech off the boxes, adversary is going to put another box in the side and you're not going to have coverage.
Hackers don't give a shit about which boxes you've ticked, right?
That's right. I think it's about having a comprehensive kind of coverage across the fleet of systems that you have. And you know, for the customers that we're working with today, thinking about containers, thinking about container workloads, it proves to be another point of, you know, access for a lot of adversaries to at least, you know, try and do nefarious things. You don't have visibility there. You don't have, you know, basic controls or good hygiene there. You know, there's going to be problems, and it might not hit today, it might not hit tomorrow, but it'll probably hit sometime in the future. And, you know, thinking ahead of this now, as people start to deploy these fabrics, is just an incredible way of getting in front of a lot of the baseline risks that others in their vertical or in their industry are probably going to face before you do.
All right, Jake King, always a pleasure to speak to you, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your time in Luxembourg, and we will speak to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pat.
That was Jake King there from CMD, and you can find them at cmd.com, and I recommend that you do. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow with a podcast all about industrial control system security. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.